You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now. Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert Dr. Kushal McGovern chats with us about the oldest meteorite crater, peptides and antimicrobial resistance, and great ape laughter. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with MP Ryan Hamilton about NZ First leader Winston Peters' comments on the India Free Trade Agreement and disagreements over the Health and Safety at Work Amendment Bill. Liam, what do you have for us today?
Hi Alex. For Green World today, I spoke to Dr. Kevin Trenberth from the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland about the extreme heat waves experienced in Europe, the causes and consequences of these extreme weather events, and what we might expect to see in the future.
He aha o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or waiamai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware, e āhei ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēnei, kōrero āno, hei pakehere rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakaturanga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we're joined by our expert, Dr. Kushal McGovern.
Kia ora.
What does the world of science have for us today?
Some really, 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 really old rocks. Isn't that exciting? I find it exciting. So Australia has, it turns out, some really old rocks. So if we think about us in New Zealand, we're quite used to being living on a plate boundary, right? That's why we get a lot of earthquakes. That's why we have a lot of volcanoes. So we don't have a lot of old rocks because rocks typically get recycled. Like they go back into the centre of the earth, they melted, they get reused kind of thing. Australia, that doesn't happen in certain parts because it's kind of not got a lot of plate boundary, right? So in the Pilbara region in Western Australia, they have these rocks that have been there for billions of years. And what they've, this paper that's come out recently is about dating some of these rocks to see how old they are. You know, you've got these rocks on the surface and they're weathered and stuff, but you can kind of, you still see evidence of what they would have looked like when they were first produced. So some of them do look kind of pillowy, like it was lava that erupted underwater and it cooled very quickly. So you get the kind of pillowy look. There are others, though, that have these really fine lines in them. And what these fine lines are indicative of is the signature of a meteorite shockwave. So something that's it's a sign of something from space hit Earth, so it's an impact crater. And so they call these shadow cones. And so obviously, okay, that's really cool, but when did this happen? How old is this impact crater? So last year, these authors published this paper that put it at 3.4 billion years old. And they called their impact crater North Pole Dome. Kind of the worst naming ever, I thought, but
yeah,
you know.
Not quite catchy.
Yeah, not really, right? But then there were some people that disagreed with this age. So this paper recently is about looking at other ways of determining age and figuring this out. So why do we care? Deep time, it's a really hard thing to conceive of. Humans, Homo sapiens, been around for about the last 300,000 years. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So how do we know what's been going on for the last 4.5 billion years? We look at the rocks. They're the things that record this history, that they tell us the story for a lot of it. But as we've, you know, with these plate boundaries, there are these earth processes, so they get buried, they get folded, heated, lifted, all these sort of things. So it makes it really hard to figure out what the story is sometimes. And that's what geologists like to do, well, some geologists. So one of the ways that you work out how old specific rocks are, so these, in this case, these specific rocks that had these shatter cones, these fine lines in it, is you do stratigraphy. So this is just looking at the layering of rocks. So if you had a nice flat surface, you get some rock laid down and then some rock, other rock on top of it, so you know the stuff that's at the bottom is older than the stuff at the top. Or if you have like a vein that goes through the rocks, you know it's younger than the rocks around it. But as we said, there's been a lot of topsy-turvy sort of thing happening. And so these geologists, what they have to do is they have to look at the rocks in one place, in another place, and they correlate them. So they look, do they look the same? Do they have the same chemistry? Do they have the same magnetic signature? And so they have to do this massive three-dimensional puzzle with all these inputs of information. And that's where this initial estimate of this impact crater being 3.4 billion years old came from. But you can imagine, because it is this topsy-turvy three-dimensional puzzle, other people can look at it and interpret that data differently or see different things. And so another group came out not long after they published their paper last year and said, well, we think it's less than 2.7 billion years old. And they put the range of ages at 2.7 to 0.4 billion years old. So massive error. And so what this group has gone back is to use other ways of dating these rocks. I suspect they were always going to do this, but it kind of became more important for them to do it. And what they've done is they've actually looked at the rocks and what in these rocks can they use to date them more specifically. So if we think about, we know radiocarbon dating for archaeological items quite a lot. You look at the levels of carbon-14 to carbon-12 and you can tell how old a piece of skin was or a piece of pottery or something. That only works to about 50,000 years old. But there are other types of these carbon dating or radiocarbon dating systems that you can use for things much older. One of them is uranium to lead. So that's where they decided, okay, we're going to use a uranium to lead system, but what are we going to look at? What are we going to find in these rocks that we can look at? So one of the things they looked at were crystals of zircon. So within these rocks, you had these fine lines, but you also had these tiny little kind of crystal inclusions that looked like frozen lightning. And the idea was that these probably formed when the meteorite impacted these rocks. So they dated those. But there are other ways that these zircons can form in the rocks. So it's not the best indication that they formed when the impact happened, right? Mm. So then they were, what else can we look at? And so then they looked at apatites, which are calcium phosphates that form when hot fluid moves through cracks in rocks. So you can imagine if there's a big meteorite impacted the Earth, there's probably a lot of cracking in the rocks, there's probably a lot of hot fluid around, and so, yeah, you would get apatite form. So they did the uranium lead dating on those as well, and the zircon and the apatite gave similar results. And so they're using this as, okay, we've got this uranium lead date from minerals that we think would have formed when this impact happened, and so they put it at 3.02 billion years. So still really, really old, but a little bit younger than it was.
Dating old rocks is... It's one of those things that I don't think I've ever super understood past, like, the bare bones I got in high school chemistry, but it's so cool.
Yeah, like, I mean, just trying to conceive of those timescales, eh? It's just beyond my brain. It's so... it's just so big.
These things have been here for so long.
And the other thing is like when you think, like I was then reading about, okay, what would the planet have looked like back then? Mm. And they basically describe it as a water world, right? Most of the planet would have been underwater and there'd only be a little bit of continent. And it, yeah, it's just so trippy to think about how the Earth has changed over all that time.
And we can still find maybe the oldest crater.
Yeah.
Even after all that time.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Well, what do we have up next?
So next is a story around antimicrobial resistance. So
not good.
Not good. And I often bring this up because it's not good. So I actually found a figure that I hadn't seen before. So in 2019, they estimate that antimicrobial resistance was directly responsible for 1.3 million deaths globally and contributed to 4.95 million deaths. So that's a lot. So it is a massively big problem. What's also really a big problem with antimicrobial resistance, though, is biofilm. So bacteria and fungi, if they're in an environment that they don't really like, what they'll do is they'll excrete stuff to basically form a protective shield around them so that they can survive. When this happens, you actually need to use a lot more antibiotic than you normally would to kill the cells because they've got this protective shell. And it's estimated that actually bacterial biofilm causes up to 75% of life-threatening infections. So not only do we need to find new ways of killing these microorganisms so that, and hopefully in ways that they're not going to develop resistance to, but we need to do it when they're in these biofilms as well. And so this is, it's been a problem for a long time. There's a lot of different methods to trying to solve it. There's been a lot of issues around, you can't make a lot of money out of it, so pharmaceutical companies maybe don't like going for it sometimes.
Lovely incentives in the medical industry.
Yeah, but one of the ways that the people have been looking at is using peptides. So peptides are just small chains of amino acids. And you can see peptides, they get sold as supplements and stuff a lot.
Quite interested.
So not endorsing any of that. This is a study that's a preclinical testing of these peptides for basically being antimicrobial in such a way that the microbes are less likely to develop resistance and can eradicate the biofilm. So us as humans, we actually produce peptides that are antimicrobial. Often it's not so much for biofilm, but as we call them planktonic. So when the bacteria are kind of floating around, so you can extract these peptides. But what's typically been found so far is that the concentration you need to eradicate biofilm has been so high that they actually become toxic for other reasons, or they're actually unstable. And so they haven't really been highly used. They've been hard to harness. But this group actually found this peptide. They said serendipitously, so by mistake, but well, they weren't looking for it, but I couldn't actually find out what they were looking for. And they call it GK17, and they found that it was really good at killing bacteria and fungi, and the bacteria and fungi don't seem to be developing resistance to it. You've got to do multiple generations of the bacteria and fungi to look at this and see how it kills. But then they'd published that about 3 years ago, and then they wanted to see, okay, can we get it to kill eradicate biofilm. So what they actually did was they made a mirror image peptide. So in nature, amino acids are all one way. They're like, you think about your left and your right hand, they're mirror images of each other, right? That's what amino acids are in nature. So you get the L type in nature. So they made their peptide out of the D type. And this is often because it's more stable and such. And they found it was actually really good at killing biofilms formed by the escape group. So the escape group is a clinically important group of pathogens. So these are the what often we test new methods around. Escape, each of the letters kind of stands for one of the species. So like S is Staphylococcus aureus, which is clinically a problem.
I know that one.
P is Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And so each of them stands for something. And they either just use topical applications, so, you know, like rubbing it on the top, or they injected it. And they found that it was really good at killing the biofilm. And the way it did, this peptide did it, was it basically poked holes in the cells. So it caused pores to form in the membrane of the cells. And so then they kind of just fail. Yep. They just get holy and fall apart.
Holes in membrane, typically not great.
Exactly, right? What's really exciting, and what I didn't realize before reading this, was it's exciting. It works against fungi. Fungi are actually a key driver of disease and death in immunocompromised people.
Mm.
But we actually only have kind of four types of antifungal drugs, so four kind of groupings, not just four names that you buy from the pharmacist sort of thing. And so fungi are developing resistance to all the four types that we have. So that's where the authors of the study were like really excited, because they're like, oh, if this works against fungi, that's awesome, because, yeah, they might be the scarier thing, it looks like.
Wow.
If you think of like The Last of Us and all those sort of...
always feels scary, fungi. I love them, but yeah, they're also terrifying.
Yeah, no, I think you need a healthy respect for them.
Right? Yeah. Just we can coexist, but please don't.
Don't kill us.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, what is up next?
So we're going to have another primate story. I've done that for the last couple of times, so I keep it going. But a happier one. So this one's actually about primates and laughter. So we all love a good laugh, right?
Of course.
I don't think anyone ever complains about having a good laugh. So living great apes, so that's us, that's chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas and orangutans, we all laugh. And what these researchers were interested in how we've developed speech, but one of the ways that they look at this is laughter across the great apes, right? And so they had recordings from multiple individuals of each of these species sort of things. Like, so they had 140 laughter sequences and they analysed them. And what they found is actually we have a very similar rhythm to the way we laugh, which I found kind of amazing. And I was like, really? And if you go on the, you can go on the website that reports this study, and you can listen to, and you can actually kind of hear it. I'm not going to try and imitate it. And it's, we basically produce these evenly spaced rhythmic intervals between the successive sounds. So, yeah, like it's kind of a, like a beat, beat, beat into your laugh kind of thing. And why this is really interesting is because we're sharing this, right? And our last common ancestor was 15 million years ago. So what that means is 15 million years ago, there was this animal or species that, you know, its progeny, it separated out into the different species, and that's what we are, the great apes now. And so that, because we all share the same rhythmic laughter or rhythm to our laughter, probably means it wasn't part of our shared common ancestor had it. So we've been doing this kind of laugh for 15 million years. What's kind of interesting though, like obviously we have evolved, right? We are speaking, we do, you know, that your laugh when you're nervous is different to the laugh that when you get tickled, to the laugh when everyone else is laughing and it's that infectious laughter, right? So our laugh has become faster, it's become more variable, and it's gained context dependent control. So, you know, we can alter our laugh in response to the context we're in.
Like words, almost.
Exactly, right.
Language.
Yeah, so it's, kind of, you know, these evolutions in the way that we control our vocalizations, right? And so that's where the laughter comes into, and then studying with speech. But I thought it was kind of, I saw the headline at first and I was like, that can't be right. Like, and then when you listen to the recordings, you're like, oh, okay. Yeah.
It's a nice and wholesome one too.
Yeah.
That's good to think about great apes laughing.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's such a joyous, I've got to go find one of those recordings because I'm sure it's awesome.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely a good thing to do in your day.
Well, but thank you so much. Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Ngā kōrero rererangi, Aviation Conversations returns on 2nd of July. Enjoy a lively panel discussion on the dark sky movement, featuring guest speakers Nikki MacArthur, MNZM, and Josh Aoraki. Book now at motat.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Up next is the Cognitive Trade-off Hypothesis by Viagra Boys.
Stones to make our food and build our homes. We collect
That was I Still Remember by Block Party. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, the India Free Trade Agreement passed its first reading in Parliament. Having already been the centre of controversy around New Zealand First's reaction to the agreement, Winston Peters has now accused the government of secretly restricting Indian immigration into Aotearoa in the agreement. Last week also saw a spat between ACT Party Deputy Leader and Workplace Relations and Safety Minister Brooke Van Velden and NZ First after Winston Peters disavowed the Health and Safety at Work Amendment Bill, despite, according to Van Velden, having offered no feedback to change the bill, which Peters rejects. I spoke to National Party MP Ryan Hamilton about these topics, starting with the India Free Trade Agreement. To get us started, the India Free Trade Agreement passed its first reading last week. Specifically, though, I want to focus on comments made by New Zealand First leader Winston Peters towards the agreement. The newest claims from Peters allege that the government is covertly restricting the flow of immigrants from India with this agreement. What is the National Party's response to these comments?
That's weird because, I mean, the Free Trade Agreement actually enhances some additional trade availability. So we're allowing about 1,660 additional skilled visas per year, or work visas, and then they can't stay more than, they can't be renewed, and they're only three-year work visas. So the most any can come in the three-year period is up to 5,000, which is only 3% of the total visas we give out. If anything, it's bumped it up slightly. It hasn't restricted, and it doesn't impact on any other existing trade arrangements.
And looking at these comments in particular, in contrast to earlier comments made by Winston Peters and NZ First, who have been criticised for anti-immigrant and racist rhetoric towards the deal, looking at both these comments together, does the National Party disavow or disagree with the rhetoric used by the NZ First to attack this bill?
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems to contrast. I mean, initially we were being criticised for having too loose an immigration setting, and now he's saying this is too restrictive. So I'm a bit confused by that. What we do know is that you know, this is a really good deal for New Zealand. I mean, it gives us access to 1.4 billion people. We have instant tariff relief on some things and gradual tariff relief on others. It's great for, you know, our exporters around particularly kiwi fruit, manuka, honey, apples, wine. And then we've still got some skill shortages in New Zealand, so this will help for needs like nurses, teachers, ICT professionals and engineers. So we're, you know, really, really happy that it strikes the right balance.
I mean, you've touched on it there, but just on the agreement itself, what sort of short-term impacts does the national government expect this agreement to have, if it goes through, on New Zealanders?
Oh, I mean, it's only additive, right? So, I mean, we've got all our existing, you know, GDP and economic performance, and we've got signs of growth coming. And if you put this in the mix, and it means all of a sudden our exporters are able to push a lot more product into an Indian market, which brings revenue back home. It opens the door for some more high-skilled individuals. So, there's no net loss for New Zealand. It's a positive thing. And when we've got volatility in some of the other markets around the world and, you know, fluctuating tariffs with the states and things like that, here's a whole new market opportunity. And we saw the same thing with China. You know, when we first, before we had our free trade agreement, trade was fairly subdued, I think around $2.5 billion, and now it's up around $18 billion. So it's only going to increase and strengthen the opportunities for Kiwis and employers and exporters.
Moving onwards, last week also saw publicised disagreement over the government's Health and Safety at Work Amendment Bill. Just to kind of kick it off, what did the government hope to accomplish with this amendment bill?
Well, essentially, you know, you've heard us talk a lot about red tape and green tape and since we've been in government. And with health and safety, it has kind of been this creep of compliance and we've seen heavy penalties and a lot increase over the last few years, particularly under the last Act. But what it's meant for small business owners is a more complexity and often a bit of confusion around are they being compliant or not, and ambiguity around the interpretation of different things. So really what we're trying to do is simplify some of that, the language, and try and make it a little bit more workable for small business owners that have, you know, maybe a team of 3 or 5 or 7. They know the risks of their job, and so we're trying to make the clarity around it and the risks proportionate.
But looking at the campaigners, particularly those from Pike River families, whose tragedy is the reason for the changes that are being repealed, they've decried this legislation as risking workplace disasters. How can the government assure New Zealanders that this isn't the case?
I think, you know, when you have tragedies like Pike River, you know, it really raises concern and, you know, emotions are high, and it's totally understandable. But we've got to take a pragmatic, proportionate view across industry. I mean, we can't compare the mining industry with, you know, a painter or painting industry. You know, there's different risks. There's work at heights versus working underground or confined spaces. But we can't rule a line and say one size fits all. We've got to be proportionate and fair. And so that's what we've tried to do. It's gone through a select committee process, and, you know, we've engaged with employers and employees and the health and safety industry and stakeholders, and we've tried to land at something that we think is balanced. It doesn't take away the need to, you know, have a health and safe work environment for large employers or small employers. We're just trying to make it more proportionate.
And once again, disagreements with this bill have emerged between particularly New Zealand Forest and Winston Peters and the minister in charge, Brooke Van Velden. Peters has vocally backed the criticisms made by Pike River campaigners, while Van Velden has said that New Zealand Forest did not give any feedback and accused the party of politicking. Where does the National Party stand on this disagreement between its two coalition partners?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, we're a three-way coalition, and we're trying to take, you know, the pragmatic road, and, you know, we've got an agreement with ACT, and we've got an agreement with New Zealand First, and it's only natural, I guess, as we go towards an election, some of those differences of opinion are going to be made, you know, more manifest and more loudly, but we're trying to find that middle road where we feel this intersects with what the majority of New Zealanders can work with, and, you know, is practical and proportionate.
Looking at these disagreements, as well as obviously the comments discussed around the free trade agreement, how do the National Party defend from concerns about the involvement of New Zealand Forest in potentially a coalition going forward if there is this perceived instability?
Well, I mean, I think it's normal in the political climate, an election climate. People are, you know, parties are wanting to shore up their vote, and often some of that vote is, you know, is competitive, and so you're going to see a lot of different interpretation of, you know, of rules or laws or policy. But when all is said and done, we've got to work together and cobble together something, and I'm confident under a leader like Christopher Luxon, he'll be able to do that like he did last time.
That was the National Party's Ryan Hamilton on the India Free Trade Agreement, Winston Peters' comments on it, and the Health and Safety at Work Amendment Bill.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
We'll be right back. Text in 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Get high. know, but you are now, boy. So sinister, so sinister. But last night was wild. What's the matter there? Feeling kind of anxious. That hot blood grew cold. Yeah, everyone, everybody knows it.
Thank you.
That was Lost My Smile by Maynard Larkin and Tom Lark, and before that was Ulysses by Franz Ferdinand. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
The last few weeks have seen one of the hottest European summers on record. In many countries across Europe, temperatures have risen well above 40 degrees Celsius. This has resulted in numerous disruptions to daily life as well as a health crisis, with over 1,000 deaths reported, notably striking countries like France. This has also had significant impacts on wildlife and agriculture, and has been seen as further evidence of the intensification of severe weather events as a result of the climate crisis. I spoke with Dr. Kevin Trenberth, honorary academic of the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland and distinguished climate science scholar, about the causes and significance of this heat wave, how it fits into broader patterns of climate change worldwide, and what responses we might expect to see going forward. So many European countries have in the last week had record high temperatures, sometimes in excess of 40 degrees Celsius. How significant is this heat wave and its impacts on human populations?
Yes, it's been, so far it's been mainly in France and Germany and southern England, and as we speak it's moving somewhat eastward and also southward, so it's affecting, beginning to affect Bulgaria and Romania and Spain and places like that. But it's been hanging around for a while, and as that heat builds in places which are not prepared for it, such as in southern England and in France, they don't have a lot of air conditioning, and so the heat can cause all kinds of problems with the population, especially the elderly population who are not able to cope with it. And my understanding is that there's been over 1,300 deaths associated with this, but there's also been many medical emergencies. And there's a lot of problems with animals of different kinds, cattle and others who are just not accustomed to this at all.
Yeah, how are people dealing with the heat waves?
Well, that's the main thing that has developed. When was it? 1976, in fact, it was 50 years ago, when they had this big heat wave that killed tens of thousands of people throughout Europe. And now the conditions are, in general about 3 to 5 degrees Celsius higher in terms of temperature than they were then. But now there are a number of cooling places that have been set up. There is some air conditioning, at least. There wasn't back in 1976. And so a lot of alerts go out in order for people to, go to these places if at all possible. But, some people are not able to do so.
Do you think there was the right level of preparation for these heat waves? Do you think some of the deaths might have been able to be avoided?
Well, yes, in many ways. There's been some studies already showing that this would not have occurred without climate change, and it's the human climate change, the buildup of carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere from human activities that are the source of a major problem here. So, these kind of conditions are impossible without human climate change. I mean, the immediate short-term cause of these is anticyclonic conditions, very settled weather conditions, but also a good southerly wind coming out of Africa, bringing a lot of hot air into the region, and it's been very sunny. The sea surface temperatures in the Mediterranean and in especially the northeast Atlantic are extremely high, very unusual. Now, part of that's because of the heat wave itself, but also that reinforces what is going on. And the oceans around the world as a whole are at the highest temperatures that I've ever been. And that's a strong indicator that something unusual is going on. And, of course, this is the human-induced climate change. And in the last 50 years, since we've had warnings about this, there have been inadequate approaches to dealing with this.
There are agreements under the United Nations from 2017, and New Zealand and other countries, led by the U.S., I might say, have been balking at addressing this at the moment. So this is indeed lack of preparation. The U.S. is likely to have their own heat wave in the next week or so. I'm wondering what that's going to do to all of the soccer matches.
And I'm curious, why is this having such a noticeable impact in Europe specifically at the moment?
Well, it's related certainly to the weather patterns, but in general around the world, the weather patterns, the main weather, if you like to think of it that way, has moved polewards. And so even in Europe and in New Zealand, it's become a little bit more subtropical in general. And that's a part of the changes in the weather pattern. So in New Zealand, you know, we refer to the westerlies and all of the weather systems progressing across and the hot conditions that we get in New Zealand don't last as long as they do in Europe. The westerlies are generally weaker in Europe, and so these anticyclones can hang around for a couple of weeks, whereas in New Zealand it's about a week usually. But, you know, we've been blessed here with quite a number of sunny days in throughout June and even in May. And part of this might be a little bit related to the El Nino pattern that is developing, but it's also got a signature related to global climate change.
Yeah, and it seems like every year we're hearing about record-breaking temperatures. Is this heat wave something that could have been foreseen? And, I mean, can we expect more of these sorts of weather events?
Yes, that's certainly very much been predicted, and now people are indeed talking about this, that if we don't do something very soon, and, you know, already this we're sort of locked into what's going to happen over the next 5 years or so. So this these kind of conditions may become quite ordinary in the future. Think of that. And instead, in the future, conditions will be hotter still. That's the way we're headed. And, you know, we're not prepared for it in general around the world.
Yeah. Would you expect Europe's and the wider world's response to this event will be?
Well, I think Europe may well respond reasonably well in terms of trying to emphasize the climate change aspects as a part that can be addressed, but I suspect a lot of it will also go into preparing more air-conditioned places and cooling centers that will allow you to sort of adapt, if you like, to these conditions. I'm not confident that anything will happen in the United States under the Trump administration, at least. And unfortunately, you know, they're a major part of the problem.
Did you expect this will galvanize efforts to, among other things, reduce carbon emissions or switch to renewable energy sources?
I'm sure there will be a lot of call for that kind of thing, and I know some of my colleagues in the UK have published letters in the Times, for instance, recently, calling for, you know, let's make real progress on cutting carbon emissions and trying to get to so-called net zero, which means net carbon emissions are zero. It doesn't mean you can't have no carbon emissions, but it means that you have to compensate any emissions with taking carbon out in other ways. You know, the short-term way of doing that is growing trees, but growing trees is not a long-term solution to that. In general, we have to cut emissions, and that's true in New Zealand as well.
Are scientists able to make predictions on, I guess, next year's weather? Are we able to anticipate a future heat wave before it happens and prepare for it better?
Not very well. In climate change, we can give general indications, but there's always weather, which is which has got a large random component, and it's not predictable for more than about 2 weeks ahead of time. Now, over the next year, there are some marked changes in the overall weather patterns that are occurring in New Zealand, Australia, and throughout the Pacific and across into the United States as well, in association with this building El Nino. Already there's an El Nino underway. This is not the time of year when it has its most profound influences, and it's apt to continue to build. Typically these events peak around December of the year, and the biggest effects are felt in about February of the following year. So that's February of 2027. Now this means a lot of heat in the ocean is moving across the Pacific and into the atmosphere. It does that a lot through evaporation, which is evaporative cooling of the ocean and then moistening the atmosphere. And then when it rains, that heat gets released into the air. And so things become a lot warmer, and it's quite possible that 2026 could be the warmest year on record. At the moment, it's projected to become second behind the last El Nino in 2024. But 2027 then would be the warmest year on record. Certainly the warmest 12 months on record will be centered around our summertime, December, January, February of 26-27. And that brings with it a real risk of drier conditions, drought in places, heat waves, and wildfires. That's especially a risk in Australia. Already Australia has had a very warm winter, but conditions haven't settled down there so that they're extremely dry yet. But that's apt to happen, and I expect we will see a lot of more wildfires there. There's already wildfires occurring in other places around the world.
Should we be concerned in New Zealand?
Yes. There are immediate impacts in New Zealand, but New Zealand is the ocean all around it, and so we're moderated to a very large degree, and we don't get 40-degree temperatures here very much unless there's a strong northwesterly with a downslope in Canterbury or something like that. So the temperatures are less of a factor, but the humidity is a real problem in New Zealand because of all of the moisture that's in the air. And sometimes there's a saying, you know, it's not just the heat, it's the humidity. And that's a big factor in New Zealand. But, you know, sea levels are rising in association with climate change, and erosion is occurring. And then when we do get rains, we get these big downpours with flooding occurring, and that's been the biggest problem, I think, in recent years in New Zealand, at least.
Yeah. Just one last question. We've heard a lot about the impacts of these heat waves on humans. Are there less obvious impacts we should be worried about, perhaps on wildlife, agriculture, or infrastructure?
Yes. So wildlife, is out there and subject to all of these conditions, both the flooding and also the hot conditions. If there are trees or shelter, you know, maybe they can get into the shade, but maybe they can move to slightly higher elevations or something like that. In New Zealand, we do have our reasonable share of clouds, and so it's not quite as bad as it is in places like Australia, where it can have a really major adverse effect on all of the wildlife, as well as farm animals of different kinds. So yeah, this is really worrying. This is the part actually that worries me, I think, the most, because humans, if they've got any sense, can get out of the heat and go into a sheltered area and a cooler area, but animals can't do that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to us. Is there anything else you wanted to add on the subject?
Well, it's an important topic, and it's not getting very much publicity. The publicity on global climate change has diminished over the last year or two, but it continues, and it's relentless. And, you know, we continue to put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is at record high levels, and it continues to go up. So we're not getting this under control at all.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Kevin Trenberth speaking about the causes and consequences of Europe's heat waves.
That was The Green World.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ke māua mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Dr. Kushla McGovern, National Party MP Ryan Hamilton, and Professor Kevin Trenberth from the University of Auckland. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1-4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.